Blog Talk Radio.
Maxim, thank you for tuning in to the Nationals. This evening we have a wonderful show that we're going to present, Treaties or United States Constitution, Which One Reigns Supreme. This is episode 2 with Brother Shem Malachi Bay. We do apologize for the delay. We had some technical difficulties, so I'm hoping that you're able to join me now. So let me see if we can get our caller on the line at this time. All right, we're on the air with Brother Shem Malachi Bay. Can you hear me this evening?
Yes, I hear you. I hear you, Tamara.
Okay, good. Thank you. Sorry about the delay we had. Was trying a new system, and somehow the interface did not go through, but we're here. So let's go ahead and get this blog talk started for this evening. Now, this evening topic, as we stated, is called Treaties, United States Constitution, Which One Reigns Supreme. Now, we're going to go ahead and get started. Now, let's start off with the Supremacy Clause within the United States Constitution. Let's deal with jurisprudence of Article 6 of the Supremacy Clause. Could you just give us some information, introduce yourself, and give us some information as we get started with this topic for tonight, because I know it's a slam pack full of information that you're going to be delivering.
Yes. The Supremacy Clause of the United States, the de jure United States Constitution of North America, was placed there, first of all, because the United States rebelled against their parent, the Crown. And by them rebelling against the Crown, they became refugees on the run. So they became refugees and they became rebels without any country, without any political structure, and therefore they needed someone to give them amnesty and asylum. Now, you have to understand that they was in rebellion against the Crown, and the indigenous Indian Moors were the allies of the Crown in France and Spain. So what the United States did was they went to France to sign a peace treaty so that way that France won't take them into as prisoners. So you have to understand what's going on when you flee the Crown, you have no status. So they got to start making alliance and doing amnesty, seeking amnesty and asylum from these powerful crowns and kings and queens of the Indian Moors. So the next step, the next treaty that they did was to get asylum be forgiven for their wrong. They wronged and their debts. They went to the Lenape queens and kings. And the Lenape kings and queens entered into a treaty with them. Now, the Lenapes are the Moors. That's the first time the Moors recognized them as being a political group, a group of political groups. When the Lenapes, being a sovereign Moorish nation, a tribe, entered into a treaty with them, it gave them asylum and it gave them amnesty. Now, by doing that, they became friends of the Lenape, who was the allies of the Crown. So, therefore, it allowed Benjamin Franklin and them to negotiate with the rebels and maneuver them into a position to enter a peace treaty with their benefactors, which is the Crown, their superior. Now, they wasn't allowed to use either to consider as a political groups or political states within the England dominion, her rim, the rim of the crown, the queen or king. Now, they went back into 1783 into a peace treaty. The first treaty entered into was 1782. That was for the gold and the debt. the debt that they're going to, they agree to continue paying their debt in exchange to use the name to be part of the political colony. But this time, they wouldn't be the colonies under the charter itself. They'll be considered as de facto the corporations operating as franchisees or franchisers of the franchisees of the franchisor, which is the colony. Now, they have to pay debts. That's why the 1782 treaty talks about how they pay debts. Now, they had an obligation, they had a right to do that now because they were considered friends of the allies of Great Britain, France, and Spain, which would be Lenape Moors. So they went to 1783 and signed a treaty called a Versailles Treaty. Now, when they signed a Versailles Treaty, now they were given permission, if you read the treaty, they were given permission to travel throughout the rim and to use the colony names as franchisees. Because the colony is the franchisor. They are corporations owned patent by the crown. So they use
So when you say colony names, you're talking about the names such as Virginia, Rhode Island, Georgia, North Carolina. So when you're saying colony names, those are the names you're referencing, correct?
Yes, yes, Tamara. Yes,
oh, okay, great. Okay.
They couldn't use the names. Go ahead, Tamara. You not done?
No, go ahead. Didn't want to cut your wisdom. Just wanted to just put that clarification in there because I think a lot of times people will mistaken, or it could be from the educational system that one deemed the name of Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, Delaware. They consider those to be of landmass. So you're saying this information gives clarity to the usage that it's a corporation name and not the name of a landmass.
Absolutely, Tamara. That's right, because the states can never own any land. They tenant. And what they do is a tenant, they sublease. So what they do is they create a servitude state in the Moors, the Indians. This is why they want to put the Indian Moors in servitude so they can create a sub-tenant status. So that way they're coming as sub-tenants and they'll be liable for the debt that they owe, that the crown placed on their back. So they'll make you pay them, and then they pay the crown, and they get the wealth in between. That's called a statutory bar. This is why the bar is the one that wrote their constitution as a settler. So getting back to what I was saying, yes, the land is not – they don't own any land. There's no case law that said they own any land. The only thing they got is they were ceded land, and that's it. And it was never conveyed because the land always been the land by the indigenous peoples in the crown. And some of the crowns itself are constantly Moors because they was melanated crowns, kings and queens that made treaties here. They was melanated. See, a lot of the people that formed the Constitution of the United States and that became president, constantly they were declaring themselves to be Moors. They were declaring themselves to be part of the Albion society. That's why they started to come out now. Their mother was Lenape Moore. Their father was Lenape Moore, but their mother was Lenape Moore. You're Moore. Thomas Jefferson. Andrew Jackson. So you got to understand, these people control the education system, and what they do is they take the wand, the paintbrush, and under the philosophy of falsehood, they paint these characters, these men, out of their character. For instance, King James, they got to paint as an Albion, but the man is a melanated man. King Charles, melanated. Mm-hmm. A lot of these big kings are melanated. So let me get back to the question so I don't get off hand. They entered a treaty. Their sovereignty first came from the Lenape Moors. Read the treaty. Anybody wants to know, stop talking, stop using assumptions. Let's look back to the history, the foundation of jurisprudence, and look at the instrument, and it will tell you how the United States was first recognized. Now, someone said, well, Great Britain acknowledged them. No, stop that. Great Britain did not acknowledge them because the Lenape Moor, the king and queens, had the same standing on the old continent that the crown had in Europe. This is their land, the kings and queens. So if they gave them a treaty and acknowledged them as something, that was the first thing they gave them a right to consider a political organization, a state. But they could not use the name and travel outside of dominion into the British realm, being acknowledged as a political organization or state until they first go back and clear up the war. They never won the war. They ceded. Let me say something.
Speaking of war, I want to pause you right there because I know how I want you to go really into that. Speaking of war, because a lot of spotlight is not shed on that, on this information when it comes down to the Revolutionary War and dealing with the Paris Treaty of 1783. Now, you spoke briefly about the Treaty of 1782. Now, go into the information regarding the treaty, the Paris Treaty that deals with the relationship with the Revolutionary War. Could you give us, I know you was about to go there, so can you kind of round that information all together?
Yes, I'm going to round it off. See, a nation could be at war with another, a people could be at war with their crown. Now, you could lose the war and surrender, but the surrender could be done through a peace treaty. Now, this is how you know who's the one surrender, when they accept the terms of the one acting as if they're in charge, given the commandments. So you got to read, these treaties and see the language and the verbiage of it. The crown is not into a peace treaty as acknowledging them as being sovereign. Hear me out. The crown is giving them orders in that peace treaty. So the United States is surrendering, but what by them surrendering, they're using it as a form of peace. Let me say what I mean. I could be at war with somebody, and I can surrender, but my surrender could be done under terms of peace, entered into a peace, meaning that I agree that they're in command and control, and I take orders from them. That's a form of surrender. Because every time you hear peace treaty, that necessarily don't mean the other parties didn't surrender. They surrender. Sometimes a peace treaty come about because one party surrendered and know they can't win the war. Now, I'm going to explain what I mean. Because you know how you know? Because all ever since then, they've been still paying the crown debts. Even now, they don't own any land. So you can see, as in the treaty, if you read a treaty, there is a form of surrender. Now, I'm going to explain what I mean. It's solid. If people don't see it. If I do a treaty with you, a peace, and we at war, and I'm commanding you what to do in the treaty and telling you what you're going to do, and you accept some terms, that's a form of surrender. But it's done under peace. It's you surrender without casualty. That's what's going on here. So that treaty of 1783 is a peace treaty, but a surrender treaty on behalf of the United States, because they are taking commandments and they're being told what to do in that treaty, and they agreeing to it. You understand what I'm saying, Tamara?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
Now, when the Civil War happened in the United States, you got something? You got another question?
No, go ahead. Not okay. Cutting your wisdom. I'm going to let you go.
Now, when the states rebelled against the United States Constitution, the alliance, General Lee ceded. He surrendered. See, he surrendered, but what happened was there was no peace treaty between the states. When he surrendered, they were still considered in rebellion. And when they broke the breach of that contract, they not only declared war against the District of Columbia, but they declared war against the indigenous people and the crown, because the peace treaty is in breach now, because the United States, as that collective body of government, was no longer in line with the treaty. So when the states and the Republic states broke away, from that, they violated the peace treaty. So there was in rebellion. So those states surrender, and the other states, those Republic states, waived their Republican and their statehood status, and they became democracies, fighting on the side of the democracy to preserve what? To preserve the peace they have with these treaties. They're not talking about it. Nobody's teaching that. So when Lee surrendered, that Republican state status they got, they surrendered without a peace treaty. They surrendered as what? Under military command. That's different now. You surrender.
Hmm.
There's no peace treaty with that surrender. There's no terms and stipulations. You just surrender. Now you're being taken under control of the District of Columbia as military force. Now you under, that's called martial law, war power. Now when Lincoln got assassinated, that war power declaration was never called in. It's still working from now until right now today. You have martial law. It never stops. So the states are what? In the sign of rebellion. How you know? They restructured their constitution. when Roosevelt came in, he took it further. He declared the War Powers Act, reaffirming it. And he took what? Took the police forces of all the states under the New World Deal, made up new constitutions, and took the flag, the fringe flag, and put it on their police officers, everybody. That means they became now operating as military service employees under martial law, under the federal government. This is why the federal government gives them their money now. They get all their money from the federal government. States allow money for the federal government. All the money the states made goes through the IRS. You issue up a bond, and they go through the IRS, and they get what you call money to operate their corporations through the surety, which are the people. That's the social trust. They are the trustees and fiduciaries for the people because they consider war. So they put them in a trust, and they invest the people as surety, and they invest the land, indigenous estate, to the United States. They will operate as trustees and surety in that trust, social trust. So in exchange for that, the United States let them raise revenue and do all this. They have to pay taxes on it. They have to return the revenue, and then they get back as a surplus. The state get back a surplus for their programs. This is how they run the school system, the streets, and all that.
So there's a lot of treaties that the treaty stands, but still not being enforced. So let's look at the landmark case of 1823. That deals with the enforcement of treaties. The Society for Propagating the Gospel in Foreign Parts versus the Town of New Haven and William Wheeler. Now, let me go over this excerpt that's within this landmark United States Supreme Court landmark case of 1823. And this section reads, "Now, the property of British corporations in this country is protected by the sixth article of the Treaty of Peace of 1783, which is, we know, is the Paris Treaty, in the same manner as those of natural persons, and their title, thus protected, is confirmed by the ninth article of the Treaty of 1794, which is the Jay Treaty, so that it could not be any intermediate legislative act or other proceeding for the defect of a lineage. The termination of a treaty by war does not divest rights of property already vested under it, nor do treaties in general become extinguished in posto facto by war between the two governments, thus stipulating for a permanent arrangement of territorial and other national rights, or at most suspended during the war and revived at the peace, unless they are waived by the parties or new and repugnant stipulations are made." Now, with that being said, does this landmark case prove that the Morris treaties are still enforceable?
Yeah, absolutely. And you also read, look what it said. It say, unless they are waived by the parties. But now, you got to understand what that means. That means the Indian Morris does not come back for the estate, if they don't step up and force the obligation of these treaties as the blood pedigree DNA of the title holders of the land, the estate holders, then they become waived. See, this is why they teach you in the school not to teach you your nationality and teach you law, because they don't want to keep that waived. A Morris treaty doesn't mean nothing if the Morris government and the Morris pedigree is not enforcing it. There has to be a claim made, and then there has to be a repossession of the rights in the estate. So to keep you from coming up to claim the estate or form any kind of government structure or system, they let you go to their school. They don't pay your teachers to teach you your history, which they're supposed to have been doing. So they are obligated to pay us, but they're not obligated to make sure that we stay in line and take and hand it down to our children, our descendants, our blood pedigree, and our piety deeds. That's not their job. And they realized that. So what they did was they came up with a scam to disnaturalize us through the education system.
Now, would that be more?
Whatever happened in war or anything, that you got to, I'm going to tell you another thing. You notice that they still operate under the War Powers Act. So they're still saying that under the Emergency War Powers Act, we're at war. And the Moors don't know that, what that means. And if it was a lawful government here, then the Moors still would be able to force the treaty because the treaty talks about war. At time of war, it's peace. At time of war. But you don't have a Moors government here. The Moors people has been stripped of everything. There's no people in the world, the North, no people like the people in the North, Moors in the Northern Hemisphere. They are stripped more than any nationality of people living on this earth, anywhere. And treaties are, the treaty that's entered to was not entered to because we was the weaker vessel or because we was a non-sovereign coming on somebody's land trying to get a new contract and economical business with them. We are the hosting nations in our own territory, domicile, dominion. Giving our open love and affection to allow other nations to come here, do commerce, and become a municipal, become a municipal country or state, and enforce their own municipal law. And now, because nobody's claiming the seat of that government, the Moors government, the state say that the estate, the land is in probate, so therefore, the not the hosting party, but the party that has been given the amnesty and asylum to be a government here, has stepped in now and says in probate, we the guardian. And now we want to stay that way because we can use them better as cattle than let them be telling us what to do. That's what it comes down to. That's why they want you to know who you are so you can't force the treaty. The treaties are more important and powerful than the Constitution because the treaty was in effect before the Constitution was created. The Constitution only had authority to be created because they was given the authority by two sovereign governments.
Now, Shem, now without the Moorish government in place and the enforcement of the treaty, because you hear rumors and you see on different social sites where people, one would say, oh, I've never seen a treaty enforced. Now, what will make a treaty to be a self-executing treaty or a non-self-executing treaty?
A treaty that is self-executed means that both of the sovereign powers agree that this is the legislative act in it, that the commandments and judgments in the treaty. I mean, it don't have to be enforced. There's no language or verbiage in the treaty saying that the other party had to rely on the other party for that to be enforced. So when something is playing out in verbiage in the language that this is how it is without any government intervening, and especially make it clear that the council is the one to handle all the business, but that's self-executed. A non self-executed treaty is when it's a treaty that can be enforced by individual. Meaning that, let's say, like the Moors turn around and succeed, incorporate themselves and get the United States a legislative exclusive power, executive power, to make decisions on their behalf as far as commerce and war, and give them the right to protect the land and regulate commerce. That is a non-self-executed treaty, meaning that it will have to be enforced either by act of Congress or through the courts.
Now, in relationship to those treaties, like, for instance, the Treaty of Peace and Friendship between His Imperial Majesty of 1780, January of 1787. Now, there's been some heated arguments, broken relationships based off this following statement alone. And most do not need consular court because we're on our own land. Could you please elaborate on the use and enforcement of that treaty and the language around that discussion? Bring some clarity to that.
Okay, the treaty of peace and friendship, the treaty of the Days of Algeria, the treaty of the Bay, they are self-executed treaties. Let me explain what I mean. They have to be executed by the council. That's stipulated in the treaty. It's self-executed. Now, The reason why the treaty is not executed, because there's not a Moore's government set up for the structure and system to actually enforce that treaty. So that's why the treaty is not being enforced. That treaty has more power as if the people of the states called New Jersey, Ohio, Delaware, Georgia, just as they have that much confidence and full faith and credit in their constitution, then that treaty has more effect. The Moors have a right to have the same affection and confidence in that treaty made by their ancient ancestors with the United States Corporation. So the only reason why the treaty does not have no effect because they created an illusion in the minds of the unconscious Moors and some of these Moors that still subconscious, who conscious but still afraid and frightened in submission to believe that the system, that they don't work. And the reason why they don't have a structure or system to turn to give them relief or remedy like the United States have for their citizens. So they have a structure body of civics set up as structure and system for remedy and procedures set up for the people of the Union Society states. The Moors don't have a political, the Moors have what you call anonymous private political organizations that has not been recognized by the world body, that has not come together and not set up proper structure, and does not have remedy for the Moors. They don't want to admit it, but I'm telling you, that's the problem.
Now, what would you deem to be those proper steps for the enforcement of the treaty?
Good question.
Well, it's not hard to figure that out if you understand jurisprudence and you sign with jurisprudence and you're a jurist. A jurist that understands positive law goes back, he looks back to the foundation of when all this was created for, constructed, where all it was structured together and made back. Then he goes to the foundation, look at the language in that some ancient treaty and how to govern their relationship with each other. Then what they do, they come out and say, how can we use that back then and force it now? You can do that if you just stop looking at present and trying to look in the future and go back to the past and look at what they did and come back and enforce that. That authority. The steps are this. The mind, claiming in the mind who you are. If it's more than, just to say, 12 to say 14 people or 7 people that know who they are and understand jurisprudence and positive law, they come together and claim their nationality, do blood pedigree, and what they do, the first step they do is they create a name for their territorial domicile. Where they're residing at or where they're living at. That's their land. Once they find out their old name, they create a nation, a national name for that national Moors nation. The next step is consciously, they together, they form what you call an alliance among each other and form a structural system. Now, let me show what I mean. Let's say they produce a document, which is you call a constitution. They may call it advisory council, a council that they regulate commerce, civics among them, and then they create another document for their piety and deity. Now, what they do is now they create a flag for that region they're at. They create their own national flag. Then from there, they create a national seal that they put on their national documents. They can patent them themselves. They can take their documents, their nationality documents, anything coming from their government, they can apostille it because it's going outside. They create their own certification seal and stamp, they stamp, and they set up government structure. Now, when they do that, the first thing they want to do is they want to reach out to other conscious Moors and say, hey, let's do this together. Let's do the same thing, and let's come together as in a confederacy. Now, I'm going to give you an example. The 5 civilized nations that created a confederacy, right, they wasn't individuals. They was from nations. They was the Lord's pedigree by these nations. These chiefs and kings to meet together from the 5 nations, there was delegated authority to come and meet and create a confederacy. That confederacy was to represent, benefit each, every nation whom they delegated that person with authority to do. They came together to regulate commerce among themselves and become strong in doing business and commerce and bartering among themselves. And it did as a confederacy to bring their military together, the strategy so no one would take their land. Any foreigner or foreign government can occupy their land. So that's how you have to do it. We have to look back into how our ancestors did it more and look at them. Let me explain what I mean. I'm going to share an example. The United States of America looked back, Benjamin Franklin, the negotiations with the Moors on how to build a structure of confederacy. The United States of America Constitution is a confederacy, a political organization. Now, you notice, like Abdu made it clear, ain't no one individual signed that. Everybody that signed that Constitution was a representative by the state. They was given delegation authority by the state, not delegated by themselves. They didn't take it upon themselves. That was delegated to them through a vote from their political organization. And that's what we have to do. They learned from us. Now let's go back and learn from our ancestors, and we'll get there faster.
You're absolutely correct on that. I think this is a great time to go ahead and take some calls. Let's see what the callers would like to know. They have some questions. They've been patiently and listen to this wonderful information that will help us to understand how we can utilize these treaties for our enforcement of our nationality and standing. So let me go ahead and take a call, 919, number ending in 0768. I'm going to go ahead and open the line for you. Have a question. Okay, you're on the line.
Peace, everybody.
Peace. Peace, brother.
Noble Ali Bay.
Okay. You have a question for Shia Malachi Bay regarding treaties or United States Constitution. Which one reigns supreme?
Yeah, now when we're enforcing this treaty, especially the Treaty of Peace and Friendship, 1787, do you get a certified copy or what do you do to enforce that through the court?
Let me say something. Let me say something. Because they're in a treaty with us, it wouldn't hurt to get a certified copy of the treaty. Let me explain what I mean. When they give you a certified copy of that treaty, they also acknowledging among themselves that that treaty is enforced. I want you to hear this. When they give you a certified copy of that treaty, they are acting, listen to me what the word certified means. When a notary certified document, he's acting as a witness. I want you to hear this. When they give you that treaty, the United States government acting as a witness that that treaty is obligated. That's why it's in their library. They're a witness. They're a witness to that treaty. That's why they give you a copy of it certified for the library. What is certified? When notary certify your document, what do you think the notary is doing? He's acting as a witness to the signature in that document. So when the United States give you a certified treaty, it is acting as a witness. The government structure to the people that signed that treaty back in the 17th century. That's why it's being certified. They're witnesses to that. So, yeah, you can get a treaty and get it certified. Then you bring it back in your government, your political, more state puts it certified. Now you got two certifications on it. Now you get the council to enforce it because the treaty said council. Doesn't say, see, this is what I tell you. The treaty doesn't say no individual. All the Moore's treaties speaks of council. The reason why that's in there, they didn't want no foreign government telling the Moors what to do. The council is the judicial authority in any dispute, criminal, civil, when it comes to any dispute between a Moor and a United States citizen or the Moors government and United States government.
So the Iroquois Confederate Constitution is a really great model to go read, understand, and to grasp the understanding of the true working of our Moorish government. That is a great foundation to go back and look at those 117 articles. It shows the formation of the different councils, the council, the council elders, and it gives direction of whom is the the lineage of how the Constitution passed down throughout the nation as the woman being the head of that nation. It also provides information of, if you look within the body of that Constitution, you will see the symbolisms of where the different emblems derive from, such as the eagle, the wampum belt, the arrows, the colors and everything is derived from the Iroquois Confederate Constitution, which is a great constitution to really study and understand the workings of a political national government. Let's take another caller. We have 917-9403. You're on the line. You have a question for Shem Malachi Bay. Good evening. Do you have a question for Shem Malachi Bay? Hello, can you hear us? Okay, looks like something is wrong with that line. Let's take a call from 714, number ending in 8147. You're on the line. Do you have a question for Shem Malachi Bay?
Islam, yes, I do. I have a question about piety and deity. I'm not exactly sure of what that means.
Okay, piety and deity?
Yes, I do. I want to
know
the exact meaning of that. I'm a little confused, and I want a clear understanding of what that means exactly.
Okay. Well, Shem, could you give more information on piety and deity?
Yeah, sure. The piety is the tradition, the rituals, the festivals, and the ceremonies and principles of law dealing with the land, air, and water, the people, affections, and obligations, restrictions, and liability on the land, air, and water that is handed down through ceremonies, festivals, traditions, festivals, and principles. Now, deity is, I mean, piety, I mean, that's handed down from your ancient ancestors. After over the period of time, they handed down to your descendants, they handed down to your descendants, you're handing down traditions, festivals, rituals, ceremonies, and principles down. Now, deity is dealing with the cosmos, the heavenly body. I mean, that's dealing with divinity and breath, air, life, spirit. That means the people, through their divinity, how they defection through their divinity, and they invoke their God, they invoke the spirit, the breath, how they invoke, how they feel in their affection towards the cosmos. They're dealing with the spiritual realm and how they lay down their trust and confidence in their high priests and their prophets who's receiving divine revelation, which is called the Jew, Deoti, which Abdul broke it down, dealing with the holder cosmic record. So they're the holders of the cosmic record. They are called the Illuminati. They are the illuminated ones that receive the cosmic record. They call them prophets, apostles, priests. This is why the Pope has our piety and deity on his fez. I would call it fez on his head. You notice he got the scepter, the crown, the keys, and the scepter, the crown, the keys, and one other thing he got, the is another image he got. And that's on his hat is dealing with piety and deity. I hope I've been a help to you.
Okay. Let's take another caller from 773, number ending in 4034. You're on the air. Do you have a question?
Islam, just saying great work to both Abdul and Shem. Doing great work and keep it going. All of this is happening is all by design, and we are not allowing it to happen. But thanks to you two guys, two brothers, peace be with you. Islam.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Thank you for tuning in to State of the Nationals every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Thank you for tuning in. Okay, let's take another call from, let's see here. Let's take another call from 302, number ending in 1508. All right, caller, you're on the air. Do you have a question regarding treaties or United States Constitution? Which one reigns supreme? Thank you for tuning in. All right, Shem, so we have the Constitution. Do you have any information that you would like? So you made it plain that the treaties is the supreme law of the land. So what is the so what is this? Let's clear up some misconceptions. The roar of the conversation of just enforce the Constitution, just enforce the Constitution. Could you bring some clarity and understanding to that when one would say just enforce the Constitution as opposed to just enforce the treaty?
The Constitution is a treaty among itself, is a treaty operating among the states collectively, meaning they all came together and entered into an alliance, which is a treaty. Now, in that treaty, that Constitution, that alliance, the charter vessel contract they set up, it just gave the central power of the United States. It talks about how they were going to regulate commerce with the indigenous people here. And in regulating commerce with indigenous people, they must first take in consideration the crown, their superior. They can't oversee them. They can't over authority. They don't have the authority over the crown or the indigenous people. So what they did was, when you say force the Constitution, you're only saying, hey, make them read the Article 6 in that Constitution as a supremacy clause. Make them read the supremacy clause. That way you're enforcing the Constitution. That means when you make them apply the supremacy clause, you're enforcing that Constitution, because now that supremacy clause trumped everything in that Constitution, because that treaty gave them the power to form that alliance that they have called a Constitution. So you hear somebody say, make them force the Constitution. Make them acknowledge that you are the people that signed treaties with the crown and them, that's in Article 6 of the Supremacy Clause.
So would that be more like an express jurisdiction?
No, that is a mandatory jurisdiction. That is,
gotcha.
That is mandatory. That cannot be called back. Like, an irrevocable is irrevocable. It can't be called back.
Now, I want to read, we have about 16 minutes. We have about 16 minutes, and I just want to read a law review excerpt. And this excerpt is from June the 1st, 2007, by Brooke L. Myers, and it's called Treaties and Federal Question Jurisdiction, Enforcing Treaty-Based Rights in Federal Courts. Now, I want to read this part where it says, power to negotiate and ratify treaties. It indicates that the President of the United States has the exclusive power to negotiate and ratify treaties. Treaties once ratified became the supreme law of the land. Significantly, the Supremacy Clause names treaties in the same textual sentence as federal statutory law. All three types of law are supreme over the laws of the several states, and states are expressly forbidden from making their own treaties. Therefore, it has long been held that treaties have the same force as federal statute, even though their scope can reach beyond Congress Article 37 powers. As such, judges are required to give effect to treaties, and treaties are included within Article 3 court's express jurisdiction. In addition, the president has the obligation and necessary authority to take care that these laws be faithfully executed. This obligation and federal court's jurisdiction are especially important because treaties are a source of international obligation towards our sovereign state. The United States is in breach of international obligation if the president fails to enforce the terms of a treaty or if the United States court's treaty interpretation fails to conform individual behavior to the agreed upon international standard. Could you go into that a little bit more? Because I know that was a lot, but this is dealing with the, you know, the international realm of the enforcement of the treaty on the Moroccan soil.
Now, let me say something. When it comes down to Moore's treaties, the President of the United States, neither the judicial courts have any authority. The treaty makes it plain. The only one that's in authority is the council. The council acts as in a place as the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. The council takes on three of the roles. Now, the council has an option. In order to enforce his obligations, his judgments, and his decrees, then he can call upon the government, legislative branch, or the courts to enforce it mandatory, not by request, not by a permission, not by approval, by delegation of authority, irrevocable, the power in those treaties, well, Moore's treaties, does not give the president, it does not give the legislature, it does not give the judiciary any power. The only way they will be able to assist in that instrument is that the council come to them and say, hey, this is the law of the land. I made a written decision. I need to file a mandamus for you, the forces in the state. That means the council is in charge. So if it's a treaty that doesn't have nothing to do with the council, then the person will go in the federal court under the Judiciary Act and say, hey, this is the law of the land. There's no other laws. There's no state statute or nothing that can override that. Now, let me explain something what this man was talking about when he was saying this is a treaty. Is that powerful if Congress passes a statute? See, when Congress passed a statute, it only applied in the jurisdiction of the District of Columbia. If they pass it and say pursuant to the Constitution, then it applies into the territorial jurisdiction of the corporate state, the franchise states. But that statute has absolutely no force on a Moore in his domicile, in his territory, and in his dominion. But the treaty has force in his domicile, his jurisdiction, and dominion. That's the difference.
Well, all right. Do you have any further? I know we're coming down to our last minutes of our hour. Do you have any more information you'd like to share with us about enforcing these treaties? Making sure that we're, you know, always honor and to make sure that these treaties are being enforced in order for our rights to stop being abridged and leaned upon.
Well, I'm going to use the everyday life of the unconscious more and the conscious more every day when they get up out of the bed. In order to get something or to be verified, you show them what? A document, a ID, a card. In order to get that card, you fill out a form, an application. You agreed upon something. You agreed to be subject to something. You agreed to be a part of something, a structural system. That's why you went there. In order to get a job, in order to apply for real estate license, become a realtor or become a cook, you go to these schools and apply. And these schools are the licensed under state law, under the state political organization. So you can see that it's a structural system set up for you to get what benefits, necessities, things of life. So if the Moors want to enforce the treaty, they have to do what the United States did. Look back into what our ancestors had established, and they established that. Let's go back, stop fighting, stop arguing. And if you're going to be a professor, be a professor. If you're going to be a dean, be a dean. If you're going to be a teacher, be a teacher. If you're going to be a cook, be a cook. But if you're not in a role of setting up government, let the men and women that the cosmos has ordained to do that do it. Listen to them. Don't fight them. Just help us come together and build financial and political structure and system. It don't take people alone to go and say they're somebody, to be a part of something, or to get some benefits. It don't take you that long to claim your inheritance or claim a house that your mother and father died and say, that was my mother and father. Why are you claiming your mother and father now? You won't claim the ones back there that died that had a government that gave these people amnesty and gave them authority to be a government here. Why are you not going back claiming them trying to get a benefit? Your past, your present life bear witness against you. What you're doing now. Why honor and say, oh, that was my grandfather. Okay, now who are these people back here? Honor the people that had integrity. Stop letting somebody tell you who the hell you are and know who you are and make a claim who you are. See, as long as you let somebody tell you, like in Dred Scott, he claimed to be an African. He couldn't get no rights. Because he went into a European court saying he's an African. And under European colonized doctrine, Africans can't be a part of their society. They have to be a government among themselves. They can't get any benefits under the Constitution. Now, if Dred Scott was a jurist, he said, yes, I'm an African whose descendants are Moors. Then he had a standing that the Constitution doesn't apply to me, the treaty does. Then they would have to look at the treaty. That's true and proven. It's positive law. Go ahead, Tammy. You got it from here.
Wow. You've gave some great information tonight. Well, one thing you have not did is you have not told us who you are. So before we close out, could you give us some information about who is Shem Malachi Bay and how can we reach you and stay connected with you? Because I know you're doing some wonderful things with the caucus that is forming, United Republic of Morocco. You also work with Brother Abdullah El Talib Mosey Bay. You're working with the Sejuris, which means the self-law class, the 10-week law class, which is currently in its fourth week. So give us a little bit information about who is Shem Malachi Bay before we close out.
Shem Malachi Bay is born of the father and mother, Moorish mother and father, in here in northwestern Mexico, Africa, in the north and western hemisphere. My family is a royal bloodline dealing with receiving stuff from the cosmos. We was told this by an old blind woman that was a prophetess. You know, she was able to see through the spirit, through the cosmos, and she made it clear that what was going on with us and all some other phenomenal things that occurred. As I got along in life, I learned statutory law as being a jurist. And in 2006 or 2007, I ran into Abdul. Abdul used to set up in South Philly. And when I heard Abdul talking, it made me feel small. I mean, all the knowledge and information and science that I learned being in courtrooms and winning cases, helping people out, I feel as though I was like in a freezer, being now had to be thawed out. Somebody took me out of freezer, took the IVs out, now I'm being thawed out. And now as the ice coming off of me, Abdul didn't rub me, put the heat in the blanket. He's waking me up. You've been froze. And I was froze. So from there on, I started grabbing all the information I can grab. And the more I was in a more science temple. Abdul used to come by and we just sell his information, do seminars. I took courses on the tithes, Abdul, commit to you. You should be at college in Jersey. What's it called? Rutgers. Commit to you to do courses at Rutgers College in New Jersey. And there's Rutgers in New Jersey.
Yeah.
He used to do classes there. So what I did was, like I tell people, the science temple that I was at, I learned a lot because they taught civics. And by us having the volume of stuff with David Wayne Miller, Noah used to do, have people come, Europeans come and do all kind of lectures and courses, I took them. And what the cosmos put inside me, it took time for that to sink in. It was working then. I couldn't get nobody never to sit at the table with me. They always would go against me because I was talking about positive law. Now, until I ran into Abdul, that's when the nucleus hit. That's when it started forming. Now it's time. I know it's time because my spiritual seer, prophet, told me, apostle said, I was going to run across somebody that was going to help me. He said, you're not going to do nothing. You're not going to prosper. That's why even though you did all that with the Hague, but it's not for you to do that by yourself. You need help. And someone will be sent to you to guide you, help you get to what you have to do. And here come Abdul. That's when I knew that was it, but nobody else. Now, point, I said, you know, your words came to pass. I said, I ran into somebody that was first man ever opened my eyes up to this right here. I said, that's amazing. The first man opened my eyes, and I'm back running to him again, going into the deep science, not only in nature, but a metaphysics dealing with the spirit and divinity. And that's the part we never could get together because we're always trying to rule each other, control each other's house. And we got to learn how to control our own house. Everything starts from the house. A house that builds what? A band. A band builds a clan. Clans build what? Tribes. So that's what about me. I'm working. I'm sitting here. I'm here for the people. I'm here to do things to get the government started. Like I said, when I get that started, I'll go back to my piety deity and do what I have to do.
Well, I would like to thank you very much for being our second nationals and helping to bring some clarity to the understanding of treaties in the United States and the enforcement and its power. So once again, I'd like to thank you for being a guest on the State of the Nationals. So I'd like to everyone to tune in every Thursday at 9 p.m. From 9 to 10 p.m. next week, we have none other than Grand Sheik Tariq Bey, who will tune in and provide information as well as we continue to just uncover more information that will help in our national standing. So thank you for tuning in to State of the Nationals, and have a good evening.